Our next presenter is Dr. Rebecca Buckley, and the talk that she's going to give is entitled Newborn Screening for Severe Combined Immune Deficiency. SCID is the acronym. And Dr. Buckley has had a distinguished career with many honors and a terribly productive career as well, and all of them reflecting her expertise in pediatrics and in immunology. She's the author of more than 300 scientific publications. She's served on more than 30 national committees in the area of immunology and pediatrics. She is the James Buren Sidbury Distinguished Professor of Pediatrics and Professor of Immunology at Duke. Recently, in September 2007, she was appointed by the U.S. Secretary of HHS to a four-year term as member of the HRSA Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders of Newborns and Children. In May 2011, she was elected a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Buckley currently serves on the ITN Data and Safety Monitoring Board for NIAID and as chairman of the Medical Advisory Committee of the Immune Deficiency Foundation. Obviously, she's actively involved in the research in which she's about to speak, in SCID particularly. So let's welcome Dr. Buckley.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hellicet, and ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to be speaking to you today instead of Marcia Boyle, who is president of the Immune Deficiency Foundation, because she had an important obligation out of the country. So she asked me to come and present this, which I think is a very important message, because many states are going to be facing this in the future as to the decision whether to screen for this condition. I have no disclosures. This is a fatal condition that we used to think was one disease, but we now know as many diseases. But all of the different molecular forms of this are characterized by one thing, and that is that there are no T cells. And you can't live without T cells. Some of them have B cells, some of them don't have B cells, but the main thing is that none of them have T cells. So one of the first things that was asked when people brought up the idea of screening for this condition was, well, how common is it? Well, the problem is that many of these babies died of pneumonia or septicemia or meningitis, and the death certificate said pneumonia or meningitis, but it didn't say SCID because people don't do autopsies anymore because insurance companies don't want to pay for them. And so yeah, you really don't know. So for those of us who were seeing these babies and taking care of them, we knew that probably it was more common than people thought. But we knew that really the only way to know for sure was to have universal newborn screening for the condition. So just to give you an idea about the frequency of these different types of SCID, over on the right you can see that 92 of the ones we've seen at my institution over the last three decades have had X-linked SCID. The next most common is adenosine deaminase deficient SCID, and then the third most common is IL-7 receptor alpha chain deficient SCID. But there are many other molecular types, and you can see that they're far less frequent. Nevertheless, they all are similarly fatal because they're all characterized by the absence of T cells. So after much discussion over many years, in February of 2010, the Secretary's Advisory Committee for Heritable Disorders of Newborns and Children unanimously voted to recommend that SCID and other severe T-cell defects be added to the list of conditions to be routinely screened for in the newborn. So in May of that same year, Kathleen Sebelius approved the recommendation with the caveat that by May of 2011, the committee came back to her with a report about how many states had initiated the screening. So why is this condition important to be screened for? Well, I've already mentioned that it is a fatal condition, and most babies don't make it to their first birthday, let alone to their second. And the other reason is that, as with other conditions that are screened for routinely in the newborn period, one has to show that if you pick it up early, there's an effective treatment. And the studies that we've done at our institution have shown that if you can treat these babies before they get sick, they have a 94% chance of surviving. The other worrisome thing is that live vaccines present a deadly challenge for these infants. And just to show you the overall survival curve for all the ones we've transplanted in our institution, on the x-axis you can see how old the baby was at the time of the transplant, and on the y-axis the percent surviving. So that those babies who were transplanted in the first, say, 150 days of life did far better than those who were transplanted afterwards. And this is what the ones who died from. They died from things that they came in with, and things that we don't have a very effective antibiotic for, like cytomegalovirus, adenovirus, EBV, and then the EBV-induced lymphoma. But other viruses like enterovirus, rotavirus, parainfluenza 3, and varicella, often from the Varivax vaccine, herpes simplex, and RSV. There were a few other miscellaneous causes of death in the others, but none of these babies died of graft versus host disease. So the live vaccines that have been associated with adverse events in people with primary immune deficiency include the chickenpox vaccine. But fortunately, that's not given until about 13 months of life. So most of these babies would have shown themselves prior to that time. MMR is a live vaccine, but in all of our experience, we've really not seen anybody with very serious problems from the MMR. The rotavirus vaccine now is another story, because the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that all babies in the United States be immunized with a rotavirus vaccine beginning at 2 months of age. But when these babies are born, they look like the Gerber baby, and they don't stop looking like the Gerber baby until they get sick. And that's usually after about 3.5 months. So at age 2 months, they would not have declared themselves. And so many pediatricians would have given the live rotavirus vaccine to these babies without knowing that they were SCID. So the treatment for this condition has been, for the last three decades, bone marrow transplantation. And these are the data from our institution, where we've transplanted 168 babies during this time. And about three quarters of them survive up through 29.4 years. The oldest patient we have who's a survivor has an MBA, and the next oldest just graduated from medical school in June of last year. So these babies can lead a normal life if they are treated early. However, there are some important things to take away from this, and that is that rarely do you have a match, so that most of the time when a baby is born with this, there's not going to be a brother or sister who can be a donor. And so what we've used instead has been a mother or father. And of course, a mother and a father can only be half matched to the baby. So to get around the graft versus host disease that would certainly occur if you didn't take out the T cells, what we do is rigorously T cell deplete the mother's bone marrow or the father's bone marrow. And then the rest of the cells you can give, because they don't cause graft versus host disease. And the other point is that if you transplant before 3.5 months of life, 94% of these babies have survived. Now, we don't use any pre-transplant chemotherapy or post-transplant GVH prophylaxis, because they don't have any T cells, and so they can't reject. And so you can avoid all the side effects of the chemotherapy drugs. And then the GVH prophylactic drugs are really immunosuppressive drugs, which would be counterproductive to your goal of restoring immune function. So now that newborn screening has been recommended by the Secretary's Advisory Committee, people are very interested in knowing about what happens with newborn transplants. So of the 48 babies that we've transplanted early, 34 of these were neonates. That is, they were 1 month, in the first month of life. and 12 of these were 10 days of age or less. The earliest was 7 days old. And the donors were mothers in 9 cases, fathers in 2 cases, or siblings in 1 case. So in 1 case, we did have a HLA identical sibling. None of the babies were infected at the time of transplant, and none of them received any chemo. So except for the marrow cell infusion, the infants were outpatients. They were admitted overnight for the cell infusion, and then they were discharged to an apartment and followed in the clinic every 1 to 2 weeks until T-cell function developed. And I didn't go into this, but it takes 90 to 120 days for stem cells to go to the baby's thymus and go to school there and learn how to be T-cells and come out as T-cells. And these babies did not have central lines. They didn't receive any GVH prophylactic drugs. And a majority of these babies were breastfed. So in addition to having a higher survival rate, the cost of treating babies in the newborn period is also much less. I had the administrators at our institution dig out the financial data for me on those who were transplanted at less than 3.5 months of life versus those who were transplanted after that time. And I think you can see that there's a huge difference. And the difference is primarily in that the ones who came in later were sick, and they often had to go to the intensive care unit. And I think it's something like $5,000 a day to stay in the intensive care unit. Those who were called early and treated early, since we didn't use chemo, they didn't even have to stay in the hospital. So most of the time, they were outpatients. So what is a method of newborn screening? Well, in Wisconsin, Massachusetts, California, New York, they're all using real-time PCR to detect TREX. Now, TREX is an acronym that stands for T-cell receptor rearrangement excision circles. And they're doing this on the dried blood spot, so the Guthrie spot that's collected for all the other things you screen for. You can get the DNA from that blood spot. And each of these states has recently identified SCIDs. The assay will identify all SCIDs, but it will also pick up other conditions like all complete DeGeorge anomaly. Now, DeGeorge, for those of you who are not physicians, is a condition where the structures that develop from the third and fourth bronchial pouches, the parathyroid gland and the thymus gland, they fail to develop. And so they have very low T cells as well. So you're going to pick up either complete or partial DeGeorges. Plus, we're already learning that we're picking up things we didn't know about. Other types of babies who have very few T cells, but we don't know their molecular defect yet. And so I'm sure that we're going to be learning a lot in the future from these babies who are screened. And this is just a cartoon to show you what TREX are. At the top of the slide there is a germline configuration for the genes involved with the T-cell antigen receptor. And in the thymus, when these T-cells are developing, they undergo a rearrangement where pieces of DNA are cut out, and that's indicated, I don't have a pointer, indicated by the dotted lines there in the middle. And when these the pieces of DNA are cut out, then they form these circles, which are in the little inset figure there. And those can be assayed by real-time PCR. So only cells that recently came out of the thymus would contain these excision circles. So for a DeGeorge patient who doesn't have a thymus, then there won't be any of these because there was no thymus for this to happen in. And for a SCID baby who doesn't have any T cells, there won't be any. Now, at the top, you can see the URL for this committee report that was sent to Kathleen Sebelius in May of this year by the advisory committee. And this was a summary of what had happened thus far. Now, in the first column, you can see the date that the given states, which are listed over on the far left there, the date they started screening. The next column is the number of months screening. And the third column is the annual birth rates, or the number that was studied in the state. And then the number of infants that had been screened as of April the 10th of this year is given in the fifth column. And in the sixth column, you can see down at the bottom, I've highlighted in red there, 14 babies with SCID have already been discovered. and six more who have what we call variant SCID or leaky SCID, where they have a few T cells, but their clonal T cells are not working very well. And then over on the far right at the bottom, you can see there are 40 other babies with other conditions, such as the George syndrome and other types of T cell deficiencies, most of whom we don't know their underlying molecular defect, but hope to in the future. So it's already picked up a lot of very at-risk babies. Now, in California, which has the largest number of births, you can see that the diagnostic category of SCID, if you include all those that were screened, the incidence of SCID they had found in the first 6 months of screening was 1 in 33,000. However, if they only focused on the Hispanic group, they found 1 in 22,000. And then for all related T lymphocyte deficiencies, it was something like 1 in 22,000. So there's going to be at least as high an incidence of these conditions as there is of like phenylketonuria and other conditions that are already screened for. So the Secretary's committee can recommend this, and the Secretary can recommend it also. But states don't have to do this. They can do whatever they want to. And of course, this is a real problem now because of the economic crisis that we're in across the country. But the Immune Deficiency Foundation that Marsha Boyle is the president of has been campaigning with the goal of having SCID included in newborn screening in all 50 states. And they are trying to do this through advocacy and education. They've been working with state health departments, supporting volunteer activities in the states, and creating and distributing educational material. So the current status of implementation is, as you can see on this slide here, that the states that are currently screening for SCID are Wisconsin, Massachusetts, California, New York, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, and I understand that Michigan has just recently started and Colorado has just recently started. Then down at the bottom of this line, I heard the other day that Connecticut has already started. So I think that there are going to be many other states that are going to be doing this in the near future. Those listed at the bottom of the slide there, their newborn screening committees have approved it, but the states haven't started, probably because of financial problems. But we're hoping that with the data from those already screened, which is around 1 million babies that have already been screened, and there are 4.5 million babies born in this country every year. So that's only about a quarter of the total population of babies that are born here. But with the addition of these other states up at the top of the slide there, someone recently calculated that once they get into full swing, that half the population in the U.S. will be screened for this condition. So once you get a positive screen, what do you do? Well, they should go see their doctor, and that doctor should get a personal and family history, because in many cases there's a family history of immune deficiency disease that somebody has never thought of before or heard about. And the doctor should do a physical examination, because if this is a baby with DeGeorge's syndrome, it's going to have other congenital anomalies. It's going to have wide-spaced eyes, low-set ears, maybe a heart defect, and the doctor can order a 22q11, which is a genetic test for DeGeorge syndrome. But more importantly, the doctor should do a complete blood count and a manual differential. And if the lymphocytes are below normal, which would be anything under 2,500, then the doctor would order flow cytometry to determine how many T cells, B cells, and natural killer cells are present. So if there are no T cells, and the baby doesn't have a funny-looking facies or heart murmur, then the primary care physician can tell the parents that the baby has a high likelihood of having a serious T-cell defect and should be isolated. But then the next thing he should do is refer this patient to an immunologist and not directly to a transplanter, because transplanters and immunologists are not always on the same page. Transplanters often are transplanters who transplant cancer patients, and they don't have a background in immunology. but the immunologist could quickly sort out whether this is SCID, whether it's DeGeorge syndrome, or whether it's some of these other conditions. And so if the lymphocyte count's not low, it could be because there are suddenly transferred maternal T cells. So in every pregnancy, there's trafficking of cells back and forth across the placenta. Mother cells enter the fetal circulation, fetal cells enter the maternal circulation. If you're a normal baby, you reject the mother cells after the first trimester of pregnancy. If you're a SCID baby, you can't reject the mother cells. So to me, it's kind of surprising that most of these babies don't get born with a lot of maternal T cells on board. But that is one thing that could adversely affect the total lymphocyte count and make it falsely high. The other thing that can make it falsely high would be a condition called Omenn syndrome, which is a condition that, unless you're a physician, you're probably not interested in hearing about. But it's a kind of leaky SCID where you have clonal T cells that really are not very effective. So another thing is that normal babies have more than 90% naive T cells, that is, they're CD45RA positive. Whereas SCID infants that have transplacentally transferred maternal cells or leaky SCID would have mainly memory T cells. So regardless of whether there are no T cells or the CD45RO positive T cells, the T cell studies would all be abnormal. So the most important study really is the T cell function study. And I've already mentioned that the screen could also pick up infants with DeGeorge syndrome. So a history of low calcium, heart murmur, finding low set ears, and a funny looking mouth that looks kind of like a fish mouth would suggest that. But the good news is that most babies with DeGeorge syndrome are going to be partial DeGeorges, and they're going to only have a slightly low percentage of T cells. So they will have significant or normal T cell function, and they don't need any immunologic treatment. They don't need a transplant. However, they probably would need to have counseling for their other congenital anomalies, so it's good that they get picked up early. If they're complete DeGeorges, which is very rare, they will look like a SCID in flow cytometry, and T cell function studies will be low, but they will need a thymus transplant, not a bone marrow transplant. So this is some of the information that the Immune Deficiency Foundation has developed. Educational pieces. This contains information for a parent of a child that is screen positive, so you can give it directly to the family and they would know a little bit about what to expect. So in conclusion, this is a pediatric emergency. The potential exists to diagnose this condition routinely at birth. If you can give a stem cell transplant from a relative in the first 3.5 months of life before infections develop, and without any pre-transplant chemotherapy, there's a very high probability of success. So T-cell-depleted HLA-identical and haploidentical marrow transplantation without pre-transplant chemotherapy provides life-saving therapy for all forms of SCID. So when I first went on the advisory committee, I think I was the only immunologist on there. Everybody else was a metabolic and endocrine person. But I think you're going to hear about other primary immune deficiency diseases that are going to be screened for in the future now that we have so many new molecular techniques for doing this. But this is the first one. Thank you very much.